Today on Against the Grain, radio in the 20th century, which you could tune into in your car or at home, had a mass audience and was a collective experience, for good or for ill. Radio today, which can be listened to when you want it, how you want it, is a much more private and atomized affair. I'm Sasha Lilly. Historian Matthew Lazar joins me to talk about the social and political choices and circumstances that led to the decline of broadcast radio and the rise of internet radio, and their implications now. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Radio is dying, we're regularly told, but it doesn't seem to ever go away. Yet what we think of as radio has changed markedly in the last quarter century, with the rise of the MP3 sound file and listening via the internet, mobile streaming, podcasts, and more. Historian Matthew Lazar terms this change Radio 2.0, in contrast to the Radio 1.0 of traditional broadcasting. And he suggests that what may look like a technical transformation in how people consume media, in fact, represents a profound social, political, and cultural shift. Lazar teaches at UC Santa Cruz and is the author of Radio 2.0, Uploading the First Broadcast Medium. Matthew, in the past when we talked about radio, it was a fairly simple affair. You had a radio receiver, you turned it on, you got AM radio, FM radio. What do we mean by radio today?
We aren't sure what we mean by radio today anymore. In the 20th century, or Radio 1.0, as I called it, we knew what radio was. First, it was AM radio, amplitude-modulated radio, and it broadcast to these things called audiences, people who all listened to the radio at the same time, simultaneously. They all listened to it at the same time, and who were conscious of the fact that they were a group of people who were listening to it at the same time and who did not have the opportunity to go back and listen to it again for the most part. Basically, they listened to it once, they heard it once, and that was it. The way that they could play it again was by talking to their friends and their family and saying, "Did you hear that? What did you think of what Franklin Roosevelt said on his fireside chat? What did you think of Bulldog Drummond? What did you think of Amos and Andy? What did you think of whatever was on at the time?" There was no chance to go back any other way or most other ways at the time. Radio was experienced as a collective experience, as something that everybody listened to together moving through time. Today, certainly for millions of people around the world, there are all kinds of things that are called radio, like Pandora, like Spotify, like YouTube music, et cetera, in which people listen to what they're listening to very individually. In the case of Pandora, which I call cubicle radio, no two Pandora listeners hear the same thing at the same time, ever. Even if they have a Pandora channel that's formally named the same thing, supposing that you and I have a Pandora channel that's called Mozart, Pandora will very, very quickly begin individualizing our channels based on your history and my history, and we will listen, we'll hear different things in that channel. So that we have radio today is asynchronous. That's a term that I identified as an important term for thinking about this in the book. Things, whereas radio in the 20th century was synchronous, radio today is asynchronous. Now, it needs to be pointed out that this kind of radio, which I call Radio 2.0, exists at the same time with Radio 1.0 still today. Millions of people still listen to conventional radio stations. They still listen to AM radio. They still listen to FM radio. But they also share that experience with this Radio 2.0 experience, so that the original broadcast experience has been marginalized in the United States. It's no longer a primary experience. Once upon a time, radio was the dominant electronic means of mass journalism or mass communications. Now it is a secondary means. Millions of people still listen to radio every day, but they listen to it much, much less every day than they used to. So radio today is a very contested term. It doesn't mean one thing. It means two things, and those two things are sort of existing with each other side by side as we go into the future. In some ways, Radio 2.0 is evolving into Radio 1.0, I argue in the book.
So you're talking about a number of significant changes. One has to do with how radio shapes the audience and the audience sense of itself.
Yes.
Another is how people are actually listening at any moment. But then also you said that just overall, no matter how people are listening to radio, that radio listenership has fallen. So what was the high point of listenership?
I would say that, about 1999, for example, people listened to radio through the day very, very consistently and through the week very, very consistently. And I would say that between 1999 and now, that daily radio listening has dropped between 4 and perhaps 10 hours or 12 hours, or even more than that, a week. Though that time is now being consumed by all kinds of internet viewing and internet listening. So that my point is that while 98% of people still are reported as listening to the radio, they listen to the radio maybe 30 and 40% less than they did, back in 1999, 1998, and certainly 1990 before the invention of the World Wide Web.
I wonder if you could give us a potted history of terrestrial radio, of traditional radio in the 20th century, because in many ways for quite a few listeners, especially younger people, this seems like the prehistory of what they think about as radio now. How did radio become the mass medium that it was in the 20th century? And how did it evolve from what is termed the golden age of radio through some significant changes as the century progressed or regressed, depending on your point of view, in terms of funding and so on?
Well, generally speaking, the moment that radio, that broadcast radio, and I use the word broadcast radio here, radio existed prior to broadcast radio. It existed as wireless telegraphy, that is to say, people using the airwaves to send Morse code to each other. In 1906, a guy named Reginald Fessenden in Nova Scotia, I think, realized that if you added a little alternator and you jacked up the speed and the power at which Morse code was being transmitted, you could actually transmit other sounds. And he just sort of did a little experiment where on Christmas Eve in 1906, he just broadcast it off to some ships and told them. And he played a violin, he put a little record on, and he sang a few Christmas tunes. And people telegraphed him back and said, "Wow, that's cool." And what's interesting about that was the president thought, well, that was nice, but it's just basically a novelty. It's nothing I can really do anything with. And he just sort of put it aside. Inventing means understanding what something's for as well as just inventing it. After that, Lita Forrest in 1910 began doing further experiments with that. And after the First World War, you had this sort of critical mass of people who came back from the war as wireless operators, and you had better alternators. And so they were able to build the first radio stations, the first famous radio stations, KDKA in Pittsburgh. It was an experiment that sort of came out of employees who worked for the Westinghouse plant in Pittsburgh. And radio very quickly spread across the United States. The Secretary of Commerce was Herbert Hoover. He recognized what a big deal this was. He very quickly began licensing radio stations. And he invented the first public interest model for regulating radio. He said that these frequencies on which it transmits, they're a public resource. In his memoirs, Hoover said he encountered lots of broadcasters who just wanted to own the frequencies. And he said, but that would be like people owning rivers. This has to belong to the public and it has to be regulated by the government. And he created the first licensing systems for that. And under that, radio flourished. The first network was NBC. And NBC created the first two national networks. And by the 1930s, radio became the dominant electronic means by which people got music and local information and then news. News actually came relatively late. It wasn't until really people got really interested in what was going on in Europe at the eve of the Second World War, that radio became news radio. Then in 1935, FM radio was invented by another engineer, and FM sounded much better. Although RCA, which dominated the technology at the time, was suspicious of FM, through the 1940s and the 1950s, FM became much more popular, and music radio stations became much more common across the United States. And through these years, radio was the foreground of electronic broadcasting. That is to say, I think that when we think about broadcast radio, we think about it in a post-World War II way of thinking about it. It's something that we just turn on. We expect it to say something. We don't like look in newspapers to see what's going to be on the radio. In the early 20th century, people. It was like cable television. You got a newspaper. You looked at the list of things that were available, and you specifically went to certain kind of shows. It was the foreground. After the Second World War, with the emergence of television mm-hmm. replaced radio as the foreground, and radio sort of evolved into the background of people. People listen to it in their cars, they listen to it in their houses, and they listen to it for formats. They listen to it for top 40 radio. But still, it was a very, very dominant way for people to get information electronically. And that lasted through the 1980s.
You also make the argument that when we're looking at radio today, radio in the past, we should not just be looking at it simply through the lens of technical change, technical innovation, that we need to actually be taking a step back and looking at the medium in terms of also the wider forces in society, and that there has been an interplay between social upheaval in this medium that kind of goes back and forth, if I understand the argument correctly. Can you tell us about that dimension to the story of radio as a kind of mass broadcast medium? Because when we think about mid-20th century America, the time when broadcast radio was particularly flourishing, it's also a time of great social and cultural change and upheaval of social movements, starting from the New Deal era and then going through the 50s, the 60s, the 70s.
This book, which I wrote, tries to navigate itself intellectually between two different strands of radio broadcasting history. One are the ideas, and they're all very good ideas. One of the ideas of Robert McChesney and more recently Victor Picard that look at the corporatization of broadcasting in the 20th century and look at lost opportunities. For example, the United States didn't have a system of public broadcasting until very, very late compared to other countries, Canada, the United Kingdom, mm-hmm. Mexico, you know, elsewhere. I mean, just, you know, all other countries, most other countries created France, created systems of public broadcasting way before the United States did. The United States opted instead for a publicly regulated but very commercialized form of broadcasting. And Picard and Robert McChesney write about that with great skill. But there's also a case to be made that despite this, broadcast radio created a mass culture in the United States and contributed to a sense of social cohesion in the United States that allowed millions of Americans to repeatedly accept new groups of people more fully into American civil society. I'm thinking, actually, of the writings of scholars like Susan Smullyan and Michelle Hilmes and Susan Douglas, who really look at the ways that broadcast medium during those years were good for America, even despite the limitations that were described earlier. It can't be a coincidence that the best years of the 20th century were also the years that broadcast radio was dominant in the United States. Broadcast radio starts in 1920 as women get the vote. It propels itself to the center of American communication during the height of the New Deal. It expands and diversifies top 40, all these different formats, and it basically narrates American society while the civil rights movement is happening. It's there in the 1970s as America becomes a much more ethnically, racially, and sexually diverse society during the so-called disco era. Radio reinforced the idea that despite all these changes, we'll still be the United States of America and we'll be better, I argue. It was a very positive reinforcing form. And I don't think it's any coincidence that the first president to really oppose all those progressive changes also opposed any public interest models for broadcast radio. I'm talking about Ronald Reagan, who was the president who really started dismantling those public interest models that basically said that radio has to it has to broadcast public affairs. It has to look for more than just one viewpoint when it broadcasts. It has to share the airwaves with local groups that are doing good things in people's neighborhoods. Ronald Reagan very quickly identified those things as real problems for his agenda and got ahead of the Federal Communications Commission, who famously, said of television, television is not a public interest appliance. Television is not a public interest device. It's basically a toaster with pictures. I'll never forget my father reading that and saying to me in the last years of his life, I can't remember the last time a toaster tried to sell me antidepressants. So in a sense, the Reagan administration delineates or, ends that era.
And we'll talk more about what then came after. Matthew Lazar is my guest. He teaches history at UC Santa Cruz. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and we're talking about his book, Radio 2.0. Staying, though, for a moment with the argument that radio created some sort of collective experience that had some relationship to the social movements and progressive change in the United States in the mid-century. Couldn't it be argued that radio also, through this kind of collectivity, it was a medium that also allowed for conformity and for building a sense of Americans that served the greater purpose of U.S. empire?
There's no question about it that radio in the 20th century reified many of the trends that you're describing. There's no question about it that radio that for example, I'll give you an example of this that sort of interests me, that is related to Pacifica Radio, by the way. Eleanor McKinney, who's one of the earliest program directors at KPFA and one of the founders of KPFA, before she was program director at KPFA, she was she worked for NBC, and she was the executive producer for a now forgotten NBC commentator named H.V. Kaltenborn, who was very famous back then. He was like, you know, Dan Rather of, you know, that kind of person. And Eleanor McKinney was the executive producer of Kaltenborn when he covered the live NBC coverage of the United Nations founding conference in San Francisco. And she would go to all of these big meetings of these, you know, famous people during this period. You know, the Second World War is as a verge of ending. And one of the people who she covered was the press conference of V.I. Molotov, who was Stalin's big, you know, foreign minister guy, and who had just met with Truman, President Harry Truman, who had just screamed at him about Poland and about, you know, you're not holding free elections in Poland. And Molotov was like, well, we haven't even figured out what's going to happen in Germany yet. And, you know, and Molotov got up and he gave a great big press conference at which he talked about how important it was that Poland not be a corridor for Central and Western Europe to invade Russia again. And he was very eloquent. And Eleanor Kimmy described to me how she, you know, she wrote everything he said down. And she gave it to V.I. Kaltenborn, and he ignored the entire all of her writing, and everything that she said, and just said his own kind of, you know, emerging Cold War, you know, comments and commentary. There is no question about that in terms of the larger a framework of empire that broadcast radio supported, you know, those parameters. I still argue that despite that, it was open and porous enough for many, many different social movements, especially social movements that were interested in a more diverse and inclusive society to be heard, and that they were heard.
Well, let's turn to the pivotal moment, which you mentioned not long ago, of the Reagan presidency and what that meant for radio. Now, you were touching on the things that Reagan kind of started the ball in dismantling that had distinguished broadcast radio, one of them being the insistence on multiple viewpoints being allowed to be aired and not just a narrow partisan focus. What do you think happened at that moment? You make the argument in Radio 2.0 that the kinds of changes that have characterized internet radio, broadly speaking, a move from the mass audience of broadcast radio to this much more niche, particular, individualized radio of the present, where people get to pick and choose what they're listening to, when they're listening to it, and don't have the sense of a mass experience listening to radio, certainly not live radio, all of these things that added to some kind of, even if it's complicated, collective experience. But you argue that we shouldn't just see this as the rise of a new technical form that supplanted the old one, that something also changed politically and societally, and that it actually preceded the rise of particular technologies that allowed for internet radio. That the move toward niche listening actually predates internet radio, and that we can see this happening in the 1980s. So tell us what happened, because that seems like the crucial moment in the story in many ways, or a crucial moment. The rise of Reagan and a turn to things that prefigured a more niche-oriented way of consuming, if we can use that term, radio.
Well, what you have in the 1980s and the late 1970s is you have a confluence of technologies and social decisions that push radio towards the more individualized kind of listening that we have today. You have, first of all, you have at the top of the, you know, at the top of the heat in terms of the regulators, a redefinition of what the public interest is. And I'm going to tell you a story.
Please.
That's about public interest radio. In the early 1960s, and so I think it sort of illustrates what the public interest meant to both regulators and to radio stations. In the early 1960s, WABC was probably one of the biggest AM radio stations. ABC, music radio ABC, was one of the biggest radio stations in the United States. When I mean biggest radio stations in the United States, I mean you could hear it in 38 states. Its signal was so powerful. It was run by a gentleman named Rick Sklar, and he was competing with a bunch of other radio stations, including one which had the voice of Philip Freed, who was probably the person who invented the term rock and roll. And he was looking for things that would really put WABC on the map. And around the same time, Jackie Kennedy managed to have a little lunch with André Malraux, who was the Minister of Culture in France and was becoming more friendly to the United States following attempts to assassinate him over what was going on in Algeria. They met, and Mrs. Kennedy asked him if the Louvre would lend the Mona Lisa to the Metropolitan Museum in New York. And he said yes. And so it was, you know, there was a big thing. The Metropolitan Museum would have the Mona Lisa. And WABC, Sklar went to his boss and he said, let's have a contest. Everybody in the area, while this is being displayed, will send us drawings of the Mona Lisa. And he had a big argument with his executive producer. And his executive said, we can't, I mean, how can we do this? And finally, they decided that they would do it. But then they couldn't figure out who was going to judge the contest for the best Mona Lisa. It was the best Mona Lisa, $100 for the best Mona Lisa, the worst Mona Lisa, the smallest Mona Lisa, and the biggest Mona Lisa. And finally, they decided, well, Salvador Dali lives near here, doesn't he? And so they got the grand old fascist, and he was at the St. Regis Hotel, and they got him to be the judge. And they said, okay, so while this thing is going on, send us your – and 15,000 people sent them drawings and paintings of the Mona Lisa, you know, from Harlem, from Chinatown, you know, from everywhere, and you know, just this outpouring of different versions of the Mona Lisa, resembling all these different diverse, you know, groups of people. There were so many that they hired an entire floor of the Arnold Constable department store to show them. They had the biggest ones. They rented out a polo field to lay them out, and the smallest one was actually on a micro dot. You actually have to look at it in a microscope to see it. I mean, I remember when I was a kid. You know, my folks took me. We went to see this. You know, we went on this. We were on this endlessly long line, finally we got in. I looked at, you know, I said, "Wow, that's small," and the guard said, "Okay, out." And we went. And we got a hot dog. What was really exciting was this, you know, WABC thing, right? No government regulator went to Rick Sklar and said to him, "You know, this is the kind of thing we want you to do," but he understood. Can you imagine a radio station doing that today?
Mm,
no, he understood that radio stations had that this was the public interest. This is the public interest model. He was fulfilling a public interest function by doing this. You know, bringing all of these diverse people together in this remarkable creative moment. Regulators saw that as the kind of things radio stations were supposed to do, sharing their resources with the public. In the late 1970s, they changed their idea. The public interest was no longer sharing inclusiveness, diversity. It was competition. This became the new byword of the public interest, and it still is to this day, even among liberal Democrats who sit on the Federal Communications Commission. The most important thing is competition. All of these good things can happen as long as we create more and more platforms, more and more competitive platforms for people to do things. So you see the deregulation of cable television starting in the late 1970s. You see the breakup of AT&T into these little separate telephone delivery entities. And finally, in the Telecommunications Act of 1996, you see the breakdown of the utility model. You know, everybody can get in anything. Telephone companies can get into radio. Telephone companies can get into video. Video companies can get into, you know, can get into telephone, get into telephone services. Everybody can do anything they want. The new byword became competition. And that somehow, if everybody was competing with everybody else, which, by the way, that's not the way it all worked out. You just wound up with more monopolies than ever before. But if everybody competes with everybody else, somehow, magically, all the kind of thing that Rick Sklar did will happen a million times more. So, you know, they basically start allowing more and more entities to buy more and more radio stations. You know, with TV stations to own more radio stations and also to own newspapers. You start the idea was somehow that if you did this, you would get these more competitive entities. If you could allow more people to basically enter into more communications industries. What it resulted in, of course, it has resulted in entities like Clear Channel, which practically invented the idea that you could make lots of money while not delivering content. That if you owned multiple radio stations, you could basically conglomerate your advertising base, and that you could avoid content. As one Clear Channel executive famously said, content is the bleep, I'm bleeping myself for you, that we broadcast between commercials. At the same time this is happening, there's all these new technologies that are emerging that predate the internet, but that individualize media. The most important of these is the Sony Walkman. The Sony Walkman in the early 1980s spread like wildfire across the United States of America. The other one was the boombox. The difference in the Sony Walkman and the boombox, and this is important, is that the Sony Walkman had headphones on, and it really created this kind of private compartmentalization. And there's a really good, interesting racial element in the battle that took place in the 1980s between the Sony Walkman and the boombox. The boombox was seen as a very racialized device, the device of the inner city, and lots of people, you know, there's lots of police monitoring of boomboxes during this period. And what's interesting is that lots of people who praised the Sony Walkman in the 1980s argued that it was an antidote to the boombox. You don't like these boomboxes? Just put on this thing and it'll blot out everything. It'll blot out the rest of the city. So this sort of predates the internet. Then, of course, the Sony Walkman CD discs emerge, and then writable CD discs emerge, and then those writable CD discs can be added to computers, and then those computers are hooked up in the internet, and the rest is history, right? The rest is, you know, is where we are now.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about the history of broadcast radio and internet radio, and I'm joined by Matthew Lazar. He teaches history at UC Santa Cruz and is the author of Radio 2.0, Uploading the First Broadcast Medium. You can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. His other books include Uneasy Listening and Pacifica Radio, The Rise of an Alternative Network. So what then did happen? You talked about the technological forerunners of the personalized listening of internet radio that moved in that direction, but there hadn't yet been the leap to what we think of now as what you're calling Radio 2.0. What happened technically and socially that led to this multiplicity of forms, many of them based around the MP3, that now dominates how we think of radio today?
Well, when the MP3 file emerged, and when all of these little, compressed files for listening to music emerged, there was a period of legal combat and chaos. Everybody here, many of you probably remember, many of our listeners probably remember the great Napster wars, you know, the Nutella wars, you know, that took place during this period. And those wars were over the fact that these companies were basically allowing people to download and broadcast, to download and receive copyrighted music and get it for free. And this happened, especially for young people, at a time when college tuition was skyrocketing. And so basically you had all of these kids who were under, who were borrowing their brains out, cost of living rising and rising and rising and rising. And here's this free thing that they can, you know, that they can get and they can just download take some of the load off, financial load off of themselves. And of course they do so in record numbers. Very quickly, the trade organizations began suing these organizations and almost all of them subsided. And in a sense you can understand Spotify and Pandora as legally organized responses to that period of copyright chaos. In fact, I think that David Byrne, who is not a big fan of music sharing, the last time I checked, David Byrne of the Talking Heads once called Pandora and Spotify legalized Napster. And I think in a very real sense, that's true. Basically, a law was created called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. It basically created rules for how often you can play things, under what circumstances you can play things. Licensed a nonprofit to collect the money, and basically put together a bunch of rules and regulations which allow people to listen to these things under highly controlled circumstances, in which it sort of feels like Napster. But somebody gets royalties, and it's organized in a way that's possible. And so, in a sense, what we have now are technological entities that are contoured by copyright laws and copyright ideas that go back a century. To about 1904 and 1905, 1906 or 1907, and the earliest copyright acts of the 20th century.
Obviously, they vary, but how would you characterize in broad terms the funding, the basis for Radio 2.0 and the security of that funding? I mean, obviously, there have been different models at different times, and the public funding of radio has been in the minority, but what is it like today and how stable is it?
It's not very stable at all. I haven't kept up with Pandora's financial affairs, but I can tell you right now that, you know, when I wrote this book, none of these companies were making a profit. They were all basically depending on continuous investment. Pandora was everybody's favorite Radio 2.0 entity, and had, you know, stored up a tremendous amount of goodwill as a result of it, but it was still struggling financially to make ends meet. The same thing for Spotify, or at least the last time I checked with it. At the same time, ironically, these entities won the undying ire of many musicians for the paucity of money that they were making for each listen, and much of that played itself out in big congressional battles between Pandora and the conventional broadcasting industry over the fact that, ironically, while Pandora has to pay royalties to musicians. Conventional broadcasters do not. Thanks to copyright decisions that were made from the early 20th century going all the way up to the 1970s when the copyright laws were revised, broadcast radio stations do not have to pay performance royalties to musicians. So nobody's happy. In a sense, in the Radio 2.0 world, nobody is happy.
Is the fact that broadcast radio doesn't have to pay these royalties one of the reasons that broadcast radio has endured, despite all the predictions that radio is dead, it's on its way out, it's over?
Yes, I think it's one of the reasons. To a large extent, Radio 1.0 continues to do reasonably well because of protectionist policies. And Radio 1.0 has been remarkably obtuse about and aggressive about using its leverage with the state to prevent newcomers from competing with it too much. I mean, there was that the famous battle of conventional broadcasters to prevent low power FM radio stations, for example. They are very, very protective of the idea that they should not have to pay performance royalties to musicians. They've got half of the House of Representatives regularly signing something called the Broadcasters Freedom Act or the Broadcasters Mother's Milk Act or the Broadcasters Purity and Cookies Act that says that they never will have to pay performance royalties to musicians. They fought like dogs and cats to prevent XM Sirius satellite radio from coming into existence. So Radio 1.0 has been very, very dogged about that, and always complaining that that's unfair, that those things are going to be unfair competition, while not protesting at all when Clear Channel is allowed to monopolize 8, 9, 10% of the radio licenses in the United States and completely dominate advertising revenue for radio stations.
Do you think that that's enough of an explanation about why radio, broadcast radio, is still around? You make the argument in your book, Radio 2.0, that there is a kind of a common sense notion that when a new technology comes along, it displaces the old, but that, going back to radio and television, that's not true.
Well, one of the things that's kind of funny, and it was kind of funny to follow while I was writing the book, was there were all these articles that were being written at the time. Radio is dead. And you starting in the early 2000s, you got all these articles. Radio is dead. It's doomed. And that they said that about when television came about, they said that radio was doomed. In fact, 1949, Look magazine wrote an article called "Radio is Doomed" because of television. So people started saying in the 2000s, radio is doomed, and then they started getting frustrated when it didn't die. And then they would start writing things like, why isn't radio dead yet? And then I think Bloomberg finally wrote an article calling broadcast radio the cockroach of electronic media. It, really sweet stuff, The roach of electronic, like the cockroaches, lasted like 50 billion years or however long. Radio just keeps on. You can't kill it. I mean, part of that is because of those laws. Part of it is also just because there's still a large constituency of people in the United States who want to listen to broadcast radio. And there's still a constituency of people who want to make broadcast radio. The FCC just licensed finally 2,000 plus low-power FM radio stations. They were all snapped up really quickly. A lot of them are now, have been constructed and are now broadcasting. This is a sign that people, that people still want that synchronous kind of broadcasting. They still want the kind of broadcasting that creates audiences, that creates communities. And podcasting is also sort of moving in that direction. You're seeing, I'm sure, when I wrote this book, podcasts were still, they were just beginning to take off. The podcast serial, which everybody really sort of glommed onto, had just completed its series when I finished this book. And now, you know, you have everybody I know listens to podcasts. I couldn't say that 4 years ago, but now everybody I know listens to podcasts. Everybody I know, they're relatively easy now to listen to on your mobile phone. You know, for a long time it was the kind of thing which only sort of nerdy people could figure out how to do it. But now everybody's doing it, and I'm experiencing, as somebody who listens to podcasts, that experience of listening to a podcast and then talking to other people. Did you hear that? And what did you think of it? So you're getting in podcasts that kind of radio 2.0 collective experience that I think has been missed. And the other thing that's great about radio, about podcasts, especially things like Welcome to Night Vale, is that it's bringing back radio drama in a way that was completely abandoned. I mean, radio drama was this great thing in the 1930s, and then it just disappeared from the face of the earth. And for, you know, generations, the way you listened to radio drama was that you basically listened to the radio dramas of the 1930s or things that sounded like the radio dramas of the 1930s. Now, with these great shows like Welcome to Night Vale, which was for a while was the biggest podcast in the world, you're getting the return of these radio dramas and audiences of people who have blogs about the podcasts, newspapers that cover, you know, each podcast, meta podcasts about the podcast, so podcasts about podcasts, Spotify lists about podcasts, YouTube playlists dedicated to podcasts. So you're getting that kind of mass audience kind of creativity again.
Well, you argue that although we should understand the move to more individualized listening of radio as being certainly based on a number of political and social choices and decisions, as well as technological change, that it also has longer historical roots and in many ways, I mean, not specifically in radio, but as a way of interacting with information dating back to the newspaper and so on. And
in some ways, it may be that 20th century radio was anomalous to the broader trends of human experience. When we read print, we read all kinds of print, right? There's newspapers, there's books, there's magazines, there's, you know, historically, there's, you know, telegraph, ticker tape, there's, you know, there's LED, you know, displays. We read text in all kinds of different contexts. It was kind of anomalous that radio was just sort of one technological thing for such a long time. And so maybe what we have now in terms of listening to radio in so many different ways is more in line with the contours of human experience.
Well, a thread that runs through your book, and let me end on this, is an essay that was written by the playwright Bertolt Brecht in 1932, an essay titled The Radio as an Apparatus of Communication. And in that, Brecht wrote about radio in a way that it would be easy to say is very prescient about what became of radio. Tell us about the essay and where you see radio left now, because it seems that what you're arguing is that through the 20th century, we had a form of radio that may be very just specific to that era. And now we have the return of other ways of taking in information. But that form, that 20th century form, is also with us still and hasn't gone. So how does Brecht help us think about this moment?
Well, let me read Brecht. 1932 essay. The radio is an apparatus of communication. Radio must be transformed from a distribution apparatus into a communications apparatus, Brecht said. The radio could be the finest possible communication apparatus in public life, a vast system of channels. That is, it could be so if understood how to receive as well as transmit, how to let the listener speak as well as hear, how to bring him into the network instead of isolating him. Following this principle, the radio should step out of the supply business and organize its listeners as suppliers. And I think that to some degree, Brecht was actually thinking about the past as well as the future. Up until the 1920s, radio operators were people who transmitted Morse code to each other back and forth, so that it was a supplier-organized form of transmission. Then broadcast radio emerged, and people basically sat back and listened and received everything and didn't have the equivalent way of talking back. They had other ways of talking back, but they didn't have the equivalent way of talking back. Now we have most fully the possibility of listeners sending as well as receiving. And we are in an era in which Brecht's ideas are being fulfilled. And the big question is, how will that change society? How will that either improve society or do other things to society? And I continue to believe that social mediums that allow us to experience ourselves as moving through time together are beneficial to society and necessary to society, necessary to nations, which I think are an important thing for people to have for a variety of reasons. But now those kinds of mediums can also fulfill Brecht's vision of the listeners as suppliers. How that's going to play itself out, I can't actually tell you that. I'm in the business of the past, not the future.
All right. Matthew Lazar, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with the author of Radio 2.0, Uploading the First Broadcast Medium. That's published by Prager. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Matthew Lazar teaches history at UC Santa Cruz and blogs for Radio Survivor. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.